34. The dog stared straight at Connor, a long string of drool sliding out of its panting jaws.
Jesus, Dan said.
That's Manrico, Caitlin said. That's the Kelton's dog.
Connor, what's happening? Lauren asked.
Connor took a step back.
The dog jumped off the roof, came toward him.
Don't look in his eyes, Connor said.
Manrico started toward them. As he had with the people who had gotten like this, Connor tried to send Manrico calming thoughts, but the dog kept leaping through the snow coming right toward him. At that moment a deer, a graceful, careful doe, came out of the woods. Her appearance was so unexpected, her form so exquisite, that even the onrushing Manrico paused and turned. She had great soft eyes and long lashes, and a face like a deep song. She walked forward, her narrow legs pushing aside snow that gleamed gold in the sun's long final rays. Then she sounded, the vaporous whistling that signals alarm in that peaceable race. Manrico's ears pointed toward her. She came closer, her delicate nose questing in the air, her eyes as calm and dark as midnight lakes. The two felt sure that the dog could be drawn away, now that the transmitter was no longer broadcasting its order to kill. He did not understand that the animal's savagery would not end. While he knew he could not control the dog's mind, he could distract it the way he was doing, by appearing to be a succulent deer. He went closer, projecting every single detail of a female deer that he could recall. Connor's voice said, "Be careful." The two went closer yet.
"Is that really a deer?" Lauren asked.
"Of course it is," Terry said.
Connor took Lauren's hand. The deer came closer. Manrico looked from her back to Connor. He growled softly, a deadly sound. The deer sounded again, then began limping as a mother deer will when her fawn is threatened. She was close now, just beyond the fence. Manrico's haunches stiffened, his ears pricked forward. He whined a little. She sounded again and limped, lurching in the snow. That did it. He leaped the fence, barking and howling as he reached her and tore into her throat. She screamed then, and suddenly she was not a deer at all. She was a gray, and in terrible trouble, being torn apart by the maddened dog. It leaped away from Manrico, one arm dangling, its head wobbling horribly. Connor screamed and ran for the fence, but Lauren tackled him.
No!
Sparks like fluid began spewing out of the gray. As the dog screamed and twisted against itself, the gray whirled faster and faster, until it became a dervish of sparks and flying fire. Then it was gone. Nothing left but a melted area of snow, some smoking earth, and the seared body of Manrico.
"Get in the car," Lauren shouted.
They did, but they could go nowhere.
"We have to change that tire," Lauren said from the back seat where she'd gotten in with Connor.
"You three stay here. I'll do it."
"I'll help," Connor said.
"No," Lauren said.
"I'll help."
Lauren responded. "No, it's too dangerous."
"Why are you so good at this?"
"I've been in training for years to be your teacher." He looked up at her and frowned.
"I find teachers extremely boring."
"I won't be." Mike was still out there somewhere, maybe incapacitated, but maybe not. She could not expose Connor to the long, clear sight lines that led back to that concealing wood. Overhead, a dark helicopter appeared, a red cross on its belly. Caitlin and Lauren got out and waved and shouted, but it set down behind the trees, in the clearing where Rob and dead Jimbo Kelton lay. Terry Kelton, who had refused to get in the car, began to cry, standing on the roadside, holding his head in agony. Another car appeared, coming from town.
"Careful," Caitlin said.
"Connor?" Lauren whispered. "Can you tell?"
"How can he possibly tell?" Caitlin snapped.
Connor closed his eyes and found that he could go racing down the snowy road and look into the car.
"It's Pauly. They're okay."
"Thank God."
"The Grays made me like this?"
"Yes, they did."
"It's never gonna end, is it?"
She smiled at him. "Do you want it to?" He met her eyes and she found it hard, very hard to look at him. She missed Adam.
Connor suddenly got out of the car.
Connor!
It's okay, Lauren. The Warners pulled up behind them. Connor started to walk toward their minivan.
No,
Lauren said, coming up to him, putting her hand on his shoulder.
No.
Listen, he said. It's okay. They're not affected. He whispered to her.
Let me go.
She released him. He got into the van.
You missed it, didn't you? Polly asked.
I got a picture on my phone.
Mom, Dad, I told you, they missed the riot.
He regarded Connor, his face alight.
There was a whole huge riot in the town, and the National Guard's there in Humvees, and it's going to be on the network news. It was totally incredible, and you missed it, little fella. Mama had to take you home.
Caitlin leaned in the window. Dan needs a hospital. We've got to take him to Berryville right now. Far above, a small silver dot glittered in the rising light of evening. The worn space inside the little craft where the three thieves had lived through so many long ages now was empty. The iron bedsteads where Caitlin and Dan had had their souls mingled, where Marcy had been laid, and Connor and so many thousands of others over the centuries, stood still and silent. As if it was alive, which it might be, the little vehicle turned round and round, looking for some place to go. The collective, at a loss, tried to understand how to replace the last triad. But who could do the work of another without training? Their minds were not flexible enough. There was no place for the little machine, nobody to replace its triad. It hung there, left empty in the sky. Connor sat quietly between Polly and Amy in the van's third row of seats. In front of them, Mom and Lauren helped his dad. He could feel his dad suffering, could hear whispers of fear coming from the implant that connected the two of them, but he intended to be very, very careful in listening to what it broadcast, to use it only if it was absolutely necessary. He wanted his dad's love, not his fear. As he listened to the humming of the tires and the soft voices of the adults, and Terry's miserable sobs, he kept feeling an absence in him, and the more he felt it, the more he came to understand that it was the absence of the collective. For a little while, being part of it had felt like a kind of music in him, and he knew that he could conduct that music, could make it bright and great and true. One day, perhaps, he would be strong enough to reach the collective on his own, to join it to his mind. Until he could, though, he would be in the most profound sense blind. He needed the three thieves. They were woven into his being, part of him. Without them, he could feel the vague, distant presence of the collective calling to him, Connor, Connor. But he could not answer. Not without the mind of the three thieves to amplify and relay his response. Connor swept out of his body and through the snowy woods, following a glowing silver wire that connected him to a burned place near the Niederdorfer's fence, where lay a pitiful little mess of rags and sticks and empty black eyes. "Wake up," he said in the secret air of the mind. "Come back to me." There was stirring in the snow, but only a little. For the damage the two had endured was very great. A sentence came to Connor. Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, and he knew that it was the love written in the Bible, a secret code for those who know. "Behold," he murmured, "he comes leaping on the mountains." And in the field, broken flesh fluttered in the night wind. In the seat in front of him, Terry Kelton sobbed, his head hanging low on his chest. Connor thought, "I can help him." He did not know how it was or why it was that he could leave his body so easily. He knew all about out-of-body travel, of course. He'd experimented with it, as he had with remote viewing and all such things, because he understood the physics of superposition and how it was that the electrons in the brain, during meditation, would become ambiguous. No longer in any one place, and you could use that to prowl in hidden pathways. He slipped upward and outward and saw in his mind's eye four Air Force guys with two aluminum gurneys in the snow. He looked at the faces of the victims and saw that John and Mrs. Kelton were alive.
"Your mom and dad made it," he told Terry. "You lost your brother and Manrico."
Terry turned around.
"How do you..."
Connor met his eyes. "Your soul knows," he said inside himself. Terry blinked, then looked away and was silent for a time. Finally a whisper.
"Thanks for telling me."
Connor had work to do. He brought to mind the three thieves as they had appeared last night, dumpy and scared, hiding behind the trees and terrified of making a mistake. He imagined them bobbing along in the night the way they had, so upset about scaring him, so unable to understand how not to.
"I need you," he said in his mind.
His thought was met by silence. They pulled into the Berryville Hospital emergency room. Medical personnel in green oversuits ran up, their portable stretcher rattling on the concrete driveway. The Air Force helicopter roared into view, dropping down onto the hospital's rooftop helipad.
"Can you see who's in it?" Lauren asked in his head.
Connor went out of his body again, traveling up to the ceiling, and found that he could go through it. He saw up the legs of people, then went higher up through the next ceiling. He was on the roof now, and he could see the Keltons lying strapped to their stretchers. There was another man there, Lauren's friend, the handsome officer with the mangled hand and the burns. Then they brought out a fourth man. He had a narrow, careful face and rusty gray hair. He was in agony, his teeth bared, his head turning from side to side as he forced himself not to scream. He raced back into his body.
"It's him," he said. "He's up there."
"Who?" Lauren asked. Connor knew what she wanted to know.
"Your friend."
Lauren burst into tears.
"Connor, what's the matter with her?"
Amy asked. He shook his head. How could he explain?
"Connor," Lauren whispered.
Then, between their minds,
"You healed him, didn't you?"
"I don't know." Amy's hand slipped toward his, hesitant, trembling a little. He took it. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against his shoulder. Paulie shook his head.
"My sis is a piece of work, buddy."
They sat side by side on blue plastic seats in the emergency waiting room. She smiled a little, and he saw one of the silver threads running between the two of them. He looked down at it, where it disappeared under his shirt. With his free hand he tried to touch it, but his hand went through it. He met her eyes and saw there a sparkle of love and hope. She closed them and he saw her face change. She threw back her head and laughed, and he put his arm around her.
"Oh, boy," Paulie said.
"Shut up, little boy," Amy snapped.
She kissed Connor on the cheek and giggled. Mom and a doctor came out of a double door across the room. The doctor said,
"Your dad's going to be fine."
Terry went to his feet. Behind the doctor, his parents had also come out. He ran to them and the family embraced. Mom sat down beside Connor and put her arm around him. As he felt the comfort of the two women, his eyes closed.
"He sure goes to sleep fast," Amy said.
"He's your little boyfriend," Paulie said.
"He's been through a lot," Caitlin responded. "He's real tired."
Behind them, a group of uniformed Air Force personnel ran into the emergency room.
"Who are they?"
Paulie asked. As they hurried through the double doors into the emergency room proper, Lauren saw Rob on his stretcher. Uttering a little cry, she went running to him. She held his face in her hands. He opened his eyes. A weak smile came.
"You're a hell of a sight," he said, his voice a bare whisper.
She tried to smile.
"Is that good or bad?"
"Good, lady. Real good."
She kissed him then.
"Sir?"
Rob turned his head away from her.
"Yes, Major."
"We're detailed to detain Colonel Wilkes."
Lauren said, "Was he in the evac?"
"Yeah,"
Rob said faintly.
"Oh, yeah."
At that moment, Charles Gunn was half pulling, half carrying Mike down a hallway. He heard voices behind them and went faster, pushing through an alarmed exit door, setting off a steady beeping behind them.
Charles's TR was there, its hatch glowing with amber light from within. Otherwise, it was invisible. He helped Mike up the ladder, then drew it in behind them. The Air Force officers swarmed out of the hospital exit and began fighting to get into the TR. Charles mercilessly shot one of them, and they all fell back. Leaving Mike in the access tunnel, he slid into the cockpit and hit the stick, causing the fans to whine for a moment as they revved. Below him, the officers were drawing their guns. He knew how vulnerable the TR was to gunfire and twisted the flight controls, slamming the power switches all the way down as he did so. The world outside whirled wildly, and critical maneuver alarms sounded. But the hospital spun away below, and the shots that were being fired did no damage. He headed the nose of the craft toward the dark, and was off into the night. Sleeping between Amy and his mom, Connor dreamed of when the Bluets would rise out of the ground along the roadsides, and the Warblers would come back to Kentucky. And he saw his own backyard going green again, and his dad filling the pool with the garden hose. He dreamed then of the days of summer peace. He woke up a little and murmured, "We're going to be free, all of us." "We are free," Amy said. "Sort of, aren't we?" "Sort of," he said. "But there's a lot more to come." But in his heart, he despaired, calling, "Come back to me." Silence continued to be the only response. "Look here, Connor Callahan. If you're going to be my boyfriend, you have to pretend not to be totally geeky. Can you do that?" He smiled a little. "I'll give it a shot." His eyes fluttered closed, and he tried again to find the mind of the collective. The snow, dark now, slowly covered the body of the two, and in the ashes of the grain elevator, the curious metal bones of his brothers also were dusted with it, deep in the black ruins. Epilogue. Late at night, when the demons come. They'd come home, he and Mom. Dad had to stay at the hospital for a few days. Lauren was with them, and Connor knew that she was going to live here. She had to. He needed her here. Late that night, Connor lay wide awake, letting his silent tears flow. He was down in his basement room. Mom was in her bedroom upstairs, and in his mind's eye he could see her sleeping. Lauren was awake. He went upstairs. She sat in the living room, sipping from a tall glass. "Connor, hi. Can't sleep?" "I'm wide awake." "Me too." She held up her drink. "Want a sip?" He shook his head. "They make me drink wine at dinner, one of Dad's many theories. Every time you do that, did you know that you kill about 6,000 neurons?" "I've heard that. I need all my neurons." "Come sit beside me." She patted the couch, and he came close to her. "Are you scared, Connor?" "Oh, yes." He looked out the dark glass doors that opened onto the deck. It was bright outside now, a low moon making the snow shine softly. "Connor?" "I want to just talk, okay? I don't like to do that mind stuff." "I didn't." "Yeah, you did. You said my name." "Connor?" "I heard that too, but it's not me." "Could it be?" "But no," he sighed. "My friends are dead." "Your friends? The Kelton boy?" "Yeah, him too. But I mean, you know, the ones we're not supposed to talk about. I need them, Lauren. I'm lost without them." "I feel that way about my friend. He was a gray, but they're not really monsters at all. They're full of need and hope and..." She stopped, looked down at him. He was so small, just an ordinary little kid, narrow shoulders, soft, unfinished face, all promise and potential. "You miss him, then?" "Earlier, I could feel him in you, sort of, and that was nice. It was like being home again, a little bit." He thought about that. "Boy, if people heard us talking about this stuff, they would think we were weird." She sensed that he didn't want to address the matter of Adam, and why would he? Adam had died for him, and that would be very hard to face. "I'm in the military," she said. "My friend, he was in his military, sort of. The Grey's military of the spirit. I mean, they have no actual army as such. In the military, though, we always know that death is part of it."
"Oh, you don't know about that. You think about life. But death is part of it."
She had to stop. She did not want him to hear the tears in her voice.
"Connor?"
He blinked, sat up straighter, stared toward the deck. That wasn't Lauren. She was leaning over with her eyes closed and full of tears, almost about to spill her drink. He got up.
"Going back to bed?"
He hardly heard her. He went out on the deck.
"Connor?"
The night was huge and hollow, the sky aflame with stars. It was cutting cold, but it felt good somehow, as if the winter night belonged to his grief. She came out behind him, and then Mom did too. Mom brought his coat. He had big lamb's wool slippers on already. "What are we doing at 3 a.m., may I know?" Then through the skeletal trees there came a glow. It flickered and was gone.
"Is that a flashlight?" his mother asked.
But Connor was off, racing down the deck stairs and across the hard, frozen yard.
"You guys!"
he yelled, his voice slapping the deep silence. He plunged through the woods, pushing twigs aside, getting scratched by branches. Then he stumbled into the stubby field and saw hanging there just 100 yards away the little ship that had started the whole thing. It wasn't glowing much now. In fact, there was just this flickering blue light playing across its skin. As he approached it, he saw that it was bigger than it looked.
"Connor, Connor, be careful."
"Take care of her, Lauren. Tell her I'm okay."
"Are you?"
"I have no idea." He went closer to the thing. It was making a sort of rattling sound, like ball bearings clicking together in something that was turning slowly, just ticking over. There was a round opening, not a hatch, just an opening. Inside, he could see the wooden framework that held the thin outer skin. He pushed at it, and it wobbled slightly in the air. He peered in. Then his mother was there.
"No,"
she said in a voice harsh with terror. "We have to get away."
"Mom, hey."
"Connor, Connor, run." She pulled at him. She started to drag him away.
"No."
He shook her off. He lifted himself inside and saw, sitting on a little bench, 3 very tattered and bedraggled Greys.
"You guys?"
They stirred, backing away.
"You guys."
"Thank you," came a nervous reply in that innocent mechanical-sounding voice of theirs.
"Thank you for our lives."
"I brought you back to life?"
"Connor, we're part of you."
"Connor, oh God, Connor." Mom came pushing and crashing in. Her eyes were filmed with tears, glaring, her face pouring with sweat despite the cold. She bared her teeth like the wild animal Connor knew she had become.
"I remember this thing," she hissed. "And it's terrible, Connor. It's evil."
The 3 thieves had backed against the wall. Inside his mind, they moaned and cried.
"Stay calm," Connor projected to them. Then he said aloud, "Mom, I want you to sit down."
There were 2 narrow black gurneys against the far wall. When she saw them, she went practically rigid. The hands of the Greys went up to their cheeks, the mouths opened. They pressed themselves against the wall as hard as they could.
"Connor, this place, this is where..."
She looked at the narrow iron gurneys.
"Oh my God."
Then her face changed.
"It was always a sort of nightmare. I didn't think it was... this."
She went to the gurneys, touched one of them.
"I remember," she said in a suddenly loud voice. "I remember it all."
Connor saw her change and become a girl again, just as Amy had become a woman before his eyes a few hours ago. She was a beautiful blonde girl, freckled, in a white summer nightgown.
and then there were stars all around her. And he saw a boy on the gurney beside her, and the stars surrounded them both. When the vision ended, Mom was sitting on the edge of one of the gurneys, stroking the ugly black metal.
"Connor," she whispered, "this is where your dad and I were brought together. Right here."
He went beside her, put an arm around her shoulders.
"If they hadn't done this, then my whole life, I never would have found Dad."
She shook her head.
"Connor, they made us. They made our family."
She looked at him, and now her eyes were soft mother's eyes. She hugged him to her. Slowly, carefully, or rather, as carefully as the clumsy thieves could manage, they came out of their hiding place and drew closer. Connor heard the one say,
"Let's touch her."
The two replied,
"We can't do that."
The three asked,
"What do we do?"
"Mom, put out your hand." She tried to, but it was shaking too much. Connor took it in his hand, and together they reached out to the three, and their hands touched. Mom snatched her hand back.
"It shocked me."
"Don't do that.
We're scared."
"They won't do it again," Connor told her. This time she reached out and touched the face of the three, and he, with his own hand shaking like a leaf, touched her face, and the one and the two came close, and the five of them formed a circle. A sound rose in Connor's mind, the great humming song he had heard before, the voice of the collective raised in hope and joy. Then there came ringing. The three thieves rushed to the far wall. The voice of the collective faded.
"What's going on in there?" Lauren asked.
"Mom, answer your phone."
The thieves looked at each other. Caitlin fumbled out her cell phone, listened for a moment.
"We'll be there," she said. She closed her phone.
"Dad's awake and he wants us." She started for the hatch and looked out on a field racing away, houses spinning in the starlight, then darkness.
"Connor, they've kidnapped us."
Then there was a thud outside and light came in the opening. Another thud and more light. Connor joined his mother at the edge of the opening.
"You know what this is?"
"No, Connor. Is it another planet? Because your poor father..."
"Come on, mother."
He helped her down onto the hospital helipad, which had been flooded by automatic lighting as soon as the thieves' craft landed on it. The thuds had been the switches turning on the flood lamps. They had not gone two steps before the body of the craft blazed bright, and the thieves shot off into the night. Connor heard faintly in his head,
"Where are you, Connor?"
"They took us to the hospital, Lauren." An orderly came out of a door and trotted across the helipad toward them.
"Where is your emergency?" he shouted.
He looked around.
"Excuse me, but what's going on here?"
"We're here to see a patient," Caitlin announced. "Dan Callahan."
"But what? Okay. Did you come by medevac? Where's the chopper?"
"He was in a hurry," Caitlin said, "and so are we."
They went down then, along a green-tiled corridor and into a room filled with equipment. And there in the bed was Dad. Connor let Caitlin go to him. She bent and gingerly kissed him. His eyes met hers, and they kissed more. Then Connor went close, and the family was whole again. High above, three others, people also, but of a very different shape, came together also, arm in arm. Lauren drove like a madwoman along snowy roads, skidding into the hospital emergency entrance. She left her car where it happened to stop against a curb and sprinted into the building. She ran down a hallway, vaulted stairs, then turned a corner and burst into Dan Callahan's room, breathing hard. She stopped, stunned by what she saw. The Callahan family had come to the end of something. Instead of huddling together, perhaps weeping, cursing God and their fate, they were all asleep. On the bed, Connor lay beside his father, who snored softly. Caitlin sat in a chair beside the bed, her head back, her mouth open. Her hand lay along the sheets,
her fingers touching her husband's bandaged arm. His good arm was around his son. As she stood in the doorway, she thought how very innocent they still were, even after all they had done and seen. And that boy, with his dusting of beard just barely visible along his lip, what dreams must he be dreaming in the ocean of thought that he now contained? She came into the room, went to the bedside, looked down at them. How extraordinarily resilient people were. Had she been asked before this, she would have said that they'd have needed sedatives or even straitjackets, but that underestimated the power of the human heart and the simple, central thing that is the family. She bent over and kissed Connor's downy cheek. He made no move, no sign of awareness. She tried to make herself quiet in her mind. The Callahans might be at peace, but in her mind there lived demons. The demon of fear of future, the demon of distrust, the demon of danger of deceit. She got the one chair that was not in use and stepped across the doorway. She sat down, angling the chair so that she could see both the Callahans, the dark window behind them, and the gleaming, silent hallway. "May I help you?" a passing nurse asked. "No, no, I'm fine. His vitals are good." "I know." The nurse smiled slightly, then walked off, her footsteps clicking on the gray floor. Lauren watched, methodically, first the hall, then the window, then the Callahans. For what, she was not sure. Perhaps for nothing. Perhaps the fight was truly ended, and Connor would be able to enter his training. But where would it lead? What was she to do? She laughed a little to herself. How absurd that question was. It would lead beyond imagination, past the edge of the known world. 3 o'clock. An alarm beeped in another room and nurses hurried past. Half past, the wind came, rattling the window. Connor sighed and muttered words that brought to Lauren's mind the tone of prayer. She prayed then to Connor's favorite god. That is to say, whatever one happens to be real. The spirit of man had triumphed this day. Ignition had been achieved. Now, the ascent. She watched through the deeper hours. Watched. And waited for the dawn. This is Stephen Lang. We hope you've enjoyed The Greys, an audio renaissance audiobook from Tor Forge. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2006 by Whitley Stryber. Production copyright 2006 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrink Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.